Hello, fellow readers. Today we are bringing you literature about sex and death with Yowande Omotosho and Efemia Chela. Welcome to A Reader's Community. I'm your host, Fasti Carlitz. Today I talk to Yowande Omotosho about her book, An Unusual Grief. As the title suggests, this is a book about loss and about death, but it's also very much a book about sex.
I struggle to connect death and desire, even though I know the two are very linked. I just know that there's this connection between those two things.
This line got me thinking about the ways in which sex and death are inextricably linked. From Freud's Eros and Thanatos, the drive to life or the sex drive, and the death drive, to the Gothic, where death is flirted with in a way that is quite erotic. I asked Efemia Chela to give us today's recommendations, and she had many interesting takes on the subject, one of which is how sex and death are linked to change or transformation, death of a previous self, or desire for a new self. This way of thinking about the link between sex and death is definitely relevant to Yowande's latest novel. An Unusual Grief is a novel about a mother, Mojisola, whose daughter dies by suicide, and Mojisola's attempt to get to know her and her life after her death. This also becomes a moment of awakening and transformation and desire for Mojisola. Here's my conversation with Yowande. Hello, Yowande, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Could we start with you introducing yourself briefly?
Yes, my name is Yowande Omotosho. I'm a writer and an architect, and I'm based in Johannesburg.
Today we're talking about your most recent novel called An Unusual Grief, which is an extraordinary novel. I absolutely loved
Thank
it.
You.
I read it for the second time recently now, and the writing is beautiful.
Thank you very much.
Could you give us a synopsis in your own words and also give us a hint about what makes Mojisola's grief so unusual?
Yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks for engaging with the book. And I think of it as a story of a woman who is alive but dead, and her daughter, who was really living, dies. And her daughter's death is an opportunity for that woman to live again. So this very strange relationship between what is it to be alive but numb. And a part of the story is also that Yinka is not only dead, but she takes her own life. So what is it to make that choice? So conscious living, conscious dying, I don't know if that's kind of controversial, but yeah, it's playing at that. I don't have any answers in the book, and I don't have any strong opinions, but it's a kind of a study or an exploration into living and dying. There's some sex, there's desire, the complexities of love and marriage, and for sure, Mojisola's grappling with motherhood.
Could you tell me how the story came about? How did it come to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think like with what I'm realizing now, third time around, like with everything I'm writing, it never comes whole. So the book as it is now only took that form, I would say, in the last 2 years, as I was now really forming what became the text, did a lot of some of the key components of the story take charge. Components such as the suicide. That's something I grappled with. I didn't want to go there. It felt really dark. It felt, could I give myself creative permission to write that story? I think creativity should not be bound by any kind of politics or rules, but I have my own personal conversation about what I can create and what I can allow myself to create. And I wasn't always sure that I wanted to write somebody who was making that choice to end their life.
Yeah.
But then I did, you know. The story is not told from Yinka's perspective directly. It's told from Mojisola's. I wanted to write about motherhood and the constraints of motherhood as it's mythologized in society, and what it means to live within those constraints and what it means to try and get free of them. I'm a mother now, but I started the book. I was only a mother, let's say. In fact, I became a mother after the book was done in many ways. So I wrote it not being a mother myself, but thinking a lot about my own mother, actually. I wanted to write about death. My mom died when I was about Yinka's age in the book, when I was about 23. And I wanted to write the story of that kind of loss, but I didn't want to write it so directly, like the loss of a mother. I thought that's just too, it's not biography. I didn't want to write my own story. And so I flipped it. I thought, well, what if I had died and my mom had lived and how would she grieve me? So that was just a kind of the seed that I started with in writing this exploration of mother-daughter, a complex relationship. I love this idea of not being, we can't access people anyway.
Mm.
And then we really can't access them if they're not even here.
Yeah. You know?
So I loved that mystery, that conundrum of trying to understand someone you didn't understand regardless, but now they're gone. So you really got nothing. And Mojisola is left with Yinka's stuff. She's left with her stuff and she tries to understand her daughter through her stuff. And I just found that intriguing. So that's kind of where I started. And all the other bits came along the way and knocked me on the side of my head and said, you know, this is what the story is. Listen to me. So that's how it went.
I think it's so interesting because Mojisola's daughter, and they weren't really in touch for the last few months before she took her life. So Yinka moved to a different city. She got a new job. All of these things that Mojisola doesn't know anything about.
Yeah.
So there's really a big question mark around Yinka's life.
Yeah.
And that's particular to their relationship. But that sense of someone being unknowable,
yes,
is an experience of grief. When you lose someone and all that you're left with is their stuff, that sort of investigation is all that's available to anyone, yeah, even if the relationship had been close.
Precisely. And it just, I guess, made that much more fraught because it hadn't. Mm. And there was so much, there were so many gaps in their relationship and question marks and silences.
Yeah. So a lot of it is about grief. We're with Mojisola as she goes through this loss. Her grief taints every aspect of the story.
Mm.
We're so close to it throughout, to its fluctuations and its unexpected manifestations and its mysterious behaviors and thoughts. It's very unpredictable in its course. I wondered what it was like to sit that closely with Mojisola and what sort of thought experiments you have to enter into in order to do that.
Yeah, yeah. It was interesting because I always say, again, it's not biographical, but I did, from very early on, I knew I would reach for a little bit of myself occasionally and a little bit of my mother to guide me in navigating these two very different people. Mojisola, who's incredibly contained because of the nature of who she is, but also perhaps her upbringing and her experiences. And Yinka, who seems determined to just bound about the earth and experience life. So some of the things that sort of guided me through the process of trying to understand Mojisola is often, like early days, I would want to do things with her and I'd have to sort of meditate a bit on my mom. So and I had such a careful conversation because, you know, Mojisola does a bunch of stuff in the book that I don't think my mother did. But the grace and the beauty of someone who is deeply contained and held and holds others, which is often the role of mothers.
Mm.
And that's sort of the mother I had, deeply graceful and quiet and centered. But I wanted to understand if this person ever chose to unravel herself or be unraveled by life, what that would look like.
Mm.
You know, so I would often oscillate between meditating on my memories of my mother. And I was really young when she died, so I don't feel like I ever had an adult interaction with my mother as I think I would have had if she lived, and I'm a mother now, and
you're
allowed different kinds of interactions with your parents, you know, when you have the opportunity to grow old with them or older. But I was still quite a young 23 when she died, and so it's very interesting to try and think of things I've never got a chance to talk to her about, and I'm now imagining. I always had a, strangely enough, a diary of my mother's that I found. Not terribly personal, but had a few of her, a gift I'd given her, like a little notebook that she'd written in. My mom had cancer, so as she was ill and in her treatment, she took some notes and left them in that book. And I found it and I'd often go to it to guide me.
Mm.
I would also reach for my aunts. I would reach for, you know, part of the challenge of writing the story is, I mean, I don't burden myself with this idea of believability because I think part of the joy of reading is also reading stuff that feels rather unbelievable. And life is pretty unbelievable. So I don't think that's a big thing to like, oh, it has to be believable, the characters. And I'm never insulted when people tell me, oh, that wasn't very believable. The insult is not that it wasn't believable. The insult is somehow I wasn't able to lure you into my unbelievable world. So,
right.
But still, all that said, I would often just temper myself with thinking of, okay, if my aunt, you know, encountered leather and whips, how would that go?
Yeah.
You know, how would that go? She's a sexual being. So I'm not coming from a place of saying,
yeah,
our elders are not sexual beings. But how is that exploration for them? How is it for that generation? So I dwelt a lot on that. I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that challenge. I'm interested anyway in general of writing about people slightly older than I am.
Mm.
A couple of decades older. That seems to be something I'm fascinated by. So it wasn't new to me to try and put myself in that world. But because of the issue of desire, which is something Mujisola, which is what her fire becomes, you know, through Yinka's death, this thing that lights up for her. I loved that challenge, you know, and it's a challenge. It's an experiment. Every book is an experiment. You're like, okay, let's see if that worked. And then, you know, find a new one for the next one. I don't know if that answered your question, but that's a long answer.
It's very interesting. And also so that what you're talking about, Mujisola being so sort of buttoned up, restrained. She as a person is very unknowable as well.
Yes, that's true.
There's a part in the book where Titus describes Mujisola, which I thought was so beautiful, where he says her body, the way she moved and spoke, seemed to be imbued with a certainty of life's dangers, ruled by caution, governed in hesitations. She was filled with a concrete silence. And then he carries on describing that kind of quality, but then the section ends off with him saying, then right on cue, her smile would spring forth from that deathly core. This remarkable joy would fill her face and scatter my mind. And I think that seed that is alive in Mujisola throughout, but then gets a little bit of chance to grow. It gets a little bit of space in this moment for the first time in her life. It's such a beautiful element of the book. And I'm also thinking about the like how desire is such a crucial element of that.
Mm.
And it kind of intrudes on the narrative. Like in one of the very early conversations when she's talking to Zelda, her daughter's landlady, and the noises of the neighbor's orgasm interrupts their conversation. And that kind of happens repeatedly. And her response to that is longing. The desire is already dormant within her.
Yeah.
So there's something about this... I don't know if it's about this loss or the fact that she steps into Yinka's shoes that facilitates her accessing her freedom and finding a bit of agency and finding this life and desire. Mm. One thing I was thinking, maybe it is a generational thing, because one of the things she's doing by stepping into Yinka's shoes is stepping into the shoes of a 23-year-old, someone who lives it. Like part of the reason why her life is so different to her mother's is because of her age and because of her generation.
Yeah.
What do you think? What do you think is the reason why this move is such a move towards freedom?
I think that's another thing I really wanted to explore is the things that give us permission. You know, I sometimes would catch my mom looking at me and I would understand that for her somehow I had certain permissions.
Mm.
You know, and I might look at her and think, well, she has certain permissions. And I think there is something interesting in a mother-daughter specifically relationship or a female guardian and a female child relationship. And I think that Yinka somehow, I mean, it's such an awful, devastating, yet beautiful gesture is that Yinka leaves Mujisola with her death. She leaves her space. You know, she leaves her a little a seat. You know, here's a seat. Sit here if you want to. And I think it's like she almost gives permission. And the death is so devastating, the suicide is so devastating that something like that has to happen that gives permission to just untether, you know, and like it's this subliminal, deeply unconscious messaging, and Mujisola hears it. You know, she knows she has to leave Cape Town. She has to leave her husband. She has to go to Midrand. She doesn't know what she's doing. She doesn't have the money. She doesn't have the whatever, the savvy, but she does it, you know, and that makes her our hero in the story, you know, in many ways, a hapless one and a deeply flawed one, but it does make her the hero because she grabs that where I think many don't and won't. you know, and that I think is, that's where she shines. I mean, there are many places where she doesn't quite match up, particularly maybe as a mom, but this last little thread, which unfortunately comes as she loses her child, she grabs, she realizes she's not going to have another chance and she grabs
it. Yeah, like it's almost like she's pushed to some sort of edge within herself, and then that pushes her to reach out and grab something.
Yeah.
So one of the things that Mojisola discovers is that Yinka was involved in the kink community. And in retracing Yinka's footsteps, she gets involved herself to some extent. Mm-hmm. And something about this unlocks her. And you were gesturing to this when you were talking about imagining your older female relatives going through this kind of thing. And not that they didn't have sexualities, but there is something about even the kink community in this novel is separate, it's secret, it's subversive.
Yeah.
It's not an ordinary part of life. It's still controversial.
Yeah.
So there's something about either that or the nature of the kink that Mojisola gets involved in that unlocks something in her. And I don't know if I'm remembering correctly, but I think when I heard you talk about this book last year on a podcast, it seemed that there was something about introducing kink that unlocked something for you in the narrative as well, that gave you a point of access that you hadn't had before.
Yeah, that's true, that it also unlocked something for me in the story. You know what? I was struggling with this book. It was like, you know, almost in a bit of a battle with the narrative, trying to get it into a shape and form. I always knew that the book would be, so death, motherhood, and desire. I really wanted to write about desire. And I struggled to connect death and desire, even though I know the two are very linked. I just sort of, I just know that there's this connection between those two things. But I didn't know where for several years was kink coming in. It wasn't even on my radar or off my radar. Like it wasn't something I was thinking about. I thought she would have a relationship, or I thought she would... and then I wrote a version of the book and we sent that out, actually. We sent that out for consideration. And when I say we, my agent and I, and got different responses. But one editor particularly was a little, I don't know, it was uncomfortable is what my reading of her comment was, that she found that a little uncomfortable. The sex, I was leaning towards kink, but I hadn't really gone full on. And a friend of mine, a writer, Anna Kena Schofield, whom I admire greatly, has this great thing she says, where she says, when people, I hope she doesn't mind me quoting, I think it's brilliant, when people, particularly editors, she says, if they find a problem with your manuscript, that's usually what's right about it, not what's wrong about it. And what you need to do is go back. Yes, you have to do more work, so they're right about that, but what you have to do is turn up the volume a bit more. And I really took that on, and I thought, I wonder if it's not kink enough. You know, I get that this person is a little uncomfortable, but maybe I haven't. She's probably uncomfortable because I'm skirting, because I'm uncomfortable. And so I didn't take it out. I put more in. And that was a point in the book, I would say maybe the last year and a half, 2 years of writing the book, where I then went full on. I researched. I was lucky to meet people in the community who welcomed me. And not in all spaces is it secretive, but I think there's still a lot of, there's so much prejudice, there's so much judgment that I think for many it still needs to be protected. I met Mistress Baton, who's this amazing South African woman. I don't know if you know her, but she's also an actress. And she has an amazing story. I don't want to tell it because I told her, you need to write your own book. But she allowed me to visit with her and speak and see her work, visit her rooms.
Yeah.
And I was able to speak to a few other people who are in the community. I myself went on to FetLife and created a profile and engaged with people. I found it enriching for me just as a person, and I felt educated. I felt like a better person. But definitely for the novel, I think it helped me understand where the book had to go. I didn't know if it'll do that well or if I'd do it well or succeed, but I understood that that was what I needed to do with the book. And then became a new challenge, because I thought, what you thought, that's going to be Mr. Thing, and she's going to have a business, and she's going to... And I was like, whoa, okay. Which is like, that ain't me. I can't do all that. So I had to reel it in a bit. And again, be tempered by who that character is and honor her. versus, you know, enjoy myself.
Yeah.
Because I think I could have written a very different book with a really, a much crazier trajectory, but I had to just keep it where it landed.
That sort of tension, well, not tension, I guess just putting someone like Mojisora in that situation, it led to one moment that I thought was very funny when she has to sort of humiliate someone and then she cannot bring herself to swear. so she can call him a rat, but she can't actually swear.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought that was wonderful. Yeah, and it's interesting because she is so restrained and so quiet, like she's characterized by the silence, the growth moments are moves for her towards expressing herself and taking charge and being in control and asserting agency instead of, I mean, I think maybe the first part of her life can be characterized by some passivity. Yeah. A lot of other people are making a lot of choices, but she's, not as empowered to make many herself. And then this is a move away from that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think of it also as the idea of the scripted life and the unscripted life.
Yeah,
you know. So there's the scripted life, you know, and she can play the parts and the roles and say the lines, and then, bam, she's suddenly in completely unscripted, you know. And which is, there's a bit of a pun there, but I mean, in many ways, it is unscripted, and she has to make it up. And the delight of that, the fear of it, the risk, but also the delight.
Mm. And in this way, Yinka, I mean, she and her daughter are quite dissimilar, and that leads to them maybe not having a strong sense of understanding each other, but it also makes Yinka's life the perfect foil or inspiration or the shake-up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to talk about mothers and daughters. So before we do that, I'm going to ask you to read from page 83, please.
Okay. Over the years, Mojisola would forget the truth of her childhood and then stumble upon the story like a detail in a book she hadn't put to memory or had misremembered. Oh, she'd say, wherever the memory found her, washing dishes, looking for a specific brand of cereal, waiting for the green light. Oh. Oh was in place of a longer sentence. Oh, that was my mother. She was my mother and I never knew her and now she's gone. Oh, that happened. That was my life, not someone else's. Oh, I really don't know myself. I'm lost. Where is my place? Here she was many years on, sitting in Yinka's apartment, having a moment of, oh. She sits on the couch, defeated by her past, wishing never to get up again. As each generation adds their poison, what chance could anyone have? What chance did Yinka have?
It's so beautiful.
Thank you.
That intrusiveness of grief in ordinary life. I mean, there's so much there, but there's something that I want to come back to that we mentioned before, which is this unknowability of other people, but how that unknowability is somehow particularly painful in the mother-daughter relationship. And also that it's tied to a sense of the self. Like if you don't know your mother, how do you know yourself? And why do you think that is? Like, why do you think this unknowability has this particular quality in this relationship in a way that it doesn't seem to cause the same wound in other kinds of relationships?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question. And again, you know, having sort of then had children soon after finishing the book, I had twins, that's why I say children, so it doesn't sound weird. But, and obviously not all mothers carry their children, but I do think part of it is if you had your children in your womb, at some point you were the same person, you know, you shared a body and you shared bodily functions. And then if the children come out and you breastfeed, they're eating you and you're feeding them yourself. I had this weird thing early days with my children where early days when they were a couple of weeks and months and they were always in a separate room. But if I woke up, I knew they were already up or they were about to be up in seconds. And it happened for about a year. I was like, what is this? Like, I'm in my room and if I open my eyes, boom, it starts. Or they're already. And I'm like, why? It's like, there's such a... And I do want to keep stating, because I know so many mothers who maybe haven't had their children in their wombs or maybe... So I'm speaking very much about a particular experience of motherhood, but definitely I do think that's part of it. part of it is the bodily, and maybe even if one isn't pregnant, but you're still with a small being, you're with their bodily functions. There's such a visceral part of mothering.
Mm.
It's so personal, it's so intimate, it's so intrusive. And then what I really thought, and I don't know if I kept that piece in the book because so much was lost in the book, so much got cut away, but this idea of the beginning of that life is deeply enmeshed and embedded. And actually what it is to grow up is to increase that distance steadily until your children are in other countries maybe, and then also other existences, if you're now an ancestor or if they pass on, like that distance is meant to grow and grow and grow until the greatest distance, which is death.
Mm.
That's the right direction. We're only meant to go in that direction, which means something is working, but also means a steady loss,
right,
of physical intimacy. And I don't know, I don't have the answer to your question, but I just wonder if somehow the answer lies in that enmeshment that is required to mother in the early days. I don't know. What do you think? I mean, I'm also curious what you might think.
I think you're right. I think also, so this biological experience, which is a certain experience of motherhood, so being pregnant and giving birth, there is that, but the fact of that also gives rise to a particular understanding of motherhood, which all mothers are a part of, regardless of how they bear children. But either way, there's still, I mean, no matter how one becomes a parent, there's still, you know, that physical contact that you're describing, that attachment, like that's, and it is very physical, you know, like skin to skin contact between babies and adults facilitates the regulation of the nervous system and breathing and heart rate and all of those things. There's a merging even after birth. So I think there is something to that. So the primary caregiver thing, and then of course the massive weight of expectations on motherhood. And thinking about how at some point someone says something about Yinka's weight to Majisola, and then she's like, oh, of course, even though Yinka is 23 and living in a different city, I'm the one who's responsible for her weight. Like this relationship between food and feeding and the mother and child. And that's, it doesn't successfully break in other people's expectations.
Exactly. Because there's so much mythology around motherhood. Very compelling mythology that some of which I'm fascinated by and subscribe to. And then very constraining mythology, because mothers are also then just people, you know, deeply incapable, you know, flawed as hell.
Yeah.
Don't know. They have hate. They have jealousy. Those are the things that I'm like, you know, jealousy between a mother and a daughter. I think that's very interesting. And I think that should be allowed in the definition.
Yeah. Like,
that shouldn't be somewhere outside of motherhood. So motherhood is love and, you know, caring and holding. But we don't also look at the other sides, those less shiny things that are there or can be there or might pop up, and, you know, and how do we allow for those that complexity? So to the end of your question, it's like the wound is because it is somewhere around, as you say, that expectation. But you are two different people at the end of the day. It's a different person with their own mother, right, and their own thing that they're carrying. And So we try and untangle all of that with varying degrees of success, of course.
Mm.
And it's a mess. It's just a mess. It's like by necessity.
What you're describing, I have in my notes here the phrase maternal ambivalence. It's something that I think, so I was going to ask you if that's something that you deliberately wanted to explore, and it sounds like you did, because it's something that I feel, at least I didn't encounter in literature or film for a long time, and now suddenly it's cropping up again and again, like reluctant mothers, maternal ambivalence. Mm. But I think even in the way I was thinking about it is like, I don't know, like almost as a, it can be read or it can be portrayed as kind of a criticism of a mother. Like this mother was not a good mother because of this maternal ambivalence. But from listening to you talk now, that's, I mean, that, yeah, it suddenly clear to me that's obviously a ridiculous way to think of it. That's motherhood. Maternal ambivalence yes. is part of motherhood, or at least many, many, most experiences of it.
Yeah. I mean, at least it should exist somewhere in the ecosystem of motherhood,
yeah,
let's say.
Yeah.
Because that's all we just want. If we think we want a range of experience and emotion, we want that for motherhood too, right?
Yes.
We, like, can't stand my kids. Then I need space. I need to, like, that shouldn't mean suddenly I'm not a mother or that
yeah.
I'm neglectful. Or it means that I'm human. It means that that experience can exist in the ecosystem of motherhood where it's too much and I'm not coping. And for everyone's sanity, I ought to step away from this for whatever, 2 seconds probably, because there's never any time. But
yeah.
How do we allow those things into the ecosystem exactly and not have it be mean judgment?
Mm.
Yeah. I loved this book. One of the books I read when I was writing this about this particular exploration, there's a book called The Mother of All Myths by Aminata Fauna, actually,
because
mm-hmm. She's written fiction, but she also has this book, it's nonfiction, about motherhood, and she looks at motherhood through the ages, like what motherhood meant at different times. Because there's a very modern, or I guess postmodern, whatever, understanding of motherhood now, where it's connected and attached, but it
yeah.
hasn't always, you know, if you go way, way, way back and in different cultures, it means different things.
Mm.
It's like, when the child starts to talk, I'll begin to interact with it. You know, this notion of singing to the child in the belly. So I appreciated that she could look at the scope and think, okay, we're in a time now and there are things we do as parents, but that's not always been the case. And also it's not always been the case in all cultures.
Mm.
I recommend the book. I really found it valuable just to give me a way to look at this thing and open up my gaze a bit.
Mm. It was interesting with Majisola when she becomes pregnant. I mean, she is a reluctant mother, but not because has come to any sort of conclusion in her mind that she doesn't want children, or it's not about her life decisions. It's almost like she doesn't associate with a narrative, you know, like there's the story of the mother and then she's on the other side, and she just doesn't see herself in that role. And therefore it's somehow
baffling
that even though that's the case, that she became pregnant.
which
I thought was really interesting. I have more questions, but we're running out of time. So we're going to have to end it there. Yeah. Love this book.
Thank you so much.
I hope it travels far.
Thank you.
Everyone should read it. Beautiful, beautiful book. Thank you so much for talking to me, Yawande.
Thanks a lot. I really, really appreciate the conversation, Vasti. And also, yeah, all the other conversations. I had a chance to listen to some of the podcasts in this series and highly recommend them to anybody listening. And thank you for your work.
Oh, great. Thank you.
The contribution.
Thanks so much.
Yawande is the author of two other books other than An Unusual Grief, which are Bum Boy and The Woman Next Door. The latter was shortlisted for the International Dublin Literary Award and longlisted for the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction. You can find her books at the Book Lounge. And if you're not in Cape Town, please do ask your local indie bookstore for it. Next, Ephemia joins me to give me her recommendations inspired by the theme of sex and death. Welcome to the podcast, Ephemia, and thanks for joining me.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Can I ask you, before we get into our book recommendations, to tell us a bit about yourself?
Okay, well, I'm Ephemia Cheller. I'm a writer, editor, and a literary critic for the Johannesburg Review of Books and other places, hopefully, if editors start responding to my pitches more positively. You should be seeing me in a lot more places. And yeah, I love books, and I'm glad to be here to talk about them today.
So today's theme is sex and death, and this is inspired by Yawande Omotosho's book, An Unusual Grief.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any general thoughts about that dyad, the sex and death dyad in literature?
Yeah, I mean, I think they are both kind of impulses that we have within us. You know, we have the sex drive and
yeah.
we have the death drive. I mean, everyone is born and everyone dies, so that's like one inevitability. But in between that, a lot of people do have sex as well. And I thought about sex and death in literature in the very physical sense, but also in the metaphorical sense, and also sex in the realm of gender and identity as well. And yeah, I found some really good books that I had almost forgotten I had read, but actually fell into the theme quite nicely.
Great. Let's hear the first one.
One of the ones I picked is probably the funniest book of them all. It's Black Ass by Eyegoni Barrett. And he's this Nigerian writer, and it's a truly hilarious book. It's set in Lagos, and it borrows a little plot-wise from Kafka's Metamorphosis.
Mm.
And the main character, Furo, wakes up one morning, and before this, he was a black man, but he wakes up as a white man, and he's white, like from the top of his head to the toes of his feet, apart from his bum. Just apart from his bum. That's like the only part of like the magical spell that overcomes him that doesn't change him. And it's interesting because we kind of journey with him dealing with the death of being recognized as a black person, because obviously he's still a black person inside, but like no one perceives him that way in Lagos. And he has this huge reversal of fortunes, change in status, job opportunities, women after him. But he can only really deal with that death of, you know, being a black person inside. And then also he's having all this sex, but you know, he doesn't really want people to see that if he turns around, he's still kind of black. And so it's a very thoughtful kind of satire of Lagos living and racial politics in Africa. But it's also deeply hilarious. I mean, one of my favorite scenes in the book is when he talks about how he had never really thought about skin lightening, but he starts getting all these skin lightening creams and he rubs them on his bum every day in the hope that it will fade. Because I think a lot of people try to manage their sex lives when they have a huge secret. And the secret is either the person or the secret is something they don't want their lover to know about. And usually it's not this, that we're actually not who we seem, but sometimes it is that. So I thought that was kind of a funny play.
Yeah, it's like the crucial moment in sex and intimacy, like the reveal, the big reveal, and then finding out the response. Risky moments. It's also interesting that it's like here, it's death as transition or transition as death. One identity being replaced by another is a kind of death, but also a kind of birth.
Yeah, it's almost like the opposite of black skin, white masks. You know, it's kind of like Fanoni in a way. And that kind of theme also runs into one of my other choices, which is honestly the best book that I read last year. And I feel like a lot of people aren't reading it because it's a trans book, but it's not just a trans book. It's like one of the best pieces of fiction I've ever read in my entire life. And I read like 80 books a year, so I know what I'm talking about. And that's Detransition Baby by Tori Peters. Have you read it?
I have read it. I absolutely loved it. It's incredibly funny. It was one of those, I was walking around and reading it out loud to whoever was around.
Because
it was just, I had to share the comedy. And it's very clever.
Yeah, it's extremely clever. And I think there's a way that queer stories are expected to be told in this very like monotone, and then the community turned on me, and then I couldn't find a home, and then there was no money for testosterone. And it kind of glosses over the fact that it's a very diverse experience, a very complicated experience, and also an experience with a lot of joy. I mean, there's so many subplots, but basically Detransition Baby deals with our theme in terms of sex. You know, it's two trans women, both assigned male at birth, have a huge issue with that at the beginning of their lives. And they kind of find each other. They're both transitioning at the same time. They form this family. They form this community. But then one of them, Ames, decides to detransition, which is part of the climax of the story. And Reese, his partner, is still a trans woman, and she desperately wants a baby. And at the start of the novel, it seems like there might be an opportunity for them to all get what they want, and they might be able to find a way to have a baby together, but it's deeply complicated. And I think that one of the really great things this novel does is show that even when you get what you want and you say goodbye to everything else that you hated, getting what you want can also include grief and can also include loss. And just how difficult it is for us to have this erroneous idea that a transition is a start point and an end point, when actually as human beings, we kind of vacillate in this loop eternally until death. And so it's a very interesting book in that way. And it also has some really great sex scenes as well. And I think people kind of either get trans sex scenes right or they become very voyeuristic. And these are quite racy, but very sensual. I loved it. It was like a rom-com in some ways, written by like a really witty trans woman.
Totally. But also quite satirical and quite intellectual. And I mean, I love stories about queer family making. Like, they're trying something so different and unusual with their family. So the birth narrative does something really interesting to their relationships and in the book.
Yeah, and I think that, like, in this weird moment of, like, J.K. Rowling discourse, books like Detransition Baby show me as a cis woman how much I can learn from trans womanhood. Like, there's things that Tori Peters is writing about in this book that I've never seen expressed by cis women authors in a way that really resonate with me.
Yeah, I totally second that recommendation. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Let's hear your next recommendation.
I also really enjoyed Luster by Raven Leilani. I mean, I feel like because of the theme, I had to have a mistress book. I feel like the mistress in literature is like a huge theme. And that's because mistresses are just so good. Like, mistresses make the world go round. And the mistress in this novel is Edie. And what I like about this is she doesn't just become a prop for the main male character. She is the story. Like, we don't actually really care what happens about him. We care about her and her journey. And it's a millennial novel. So if you're kind of into Sally Rooney vibes, which a lot of people are, I would say this is like the black female New York version of that. And so it's this disaffected young woman in a dead-end job, a cruel big city, and she's having lots of regrettable but deeply transformative sexual experiences. And you get this really messy and glorious portrait of this, like, young woman trying to become an artist and getting distracted by a throuple situation, essentially. So, like all mistresses, you know, it starts off with her just sleeping with the man, and then she kind of gets pulled into something which is deeply sexual. I think the sex is the initial hook, but what actually gets her is this kind of pseudo-familial intimacy. And so she starts hanging out with the wife as well, and it's not clear if they're sister wives or mother or daughter or, like, best friends. And, of course, racial politics come into it a lot because, you know, being a black person in America, death is something that's at the forefront of your mind. And this white couple happened to have a black adopted daughter. And so the death element, in my experience from having affairs, I feel that the nature of an affair is that it requires a little bit of a death of yourself. There's just something about it. And, you know, Raven Leilani takes us through Edie's journey of almost killing herself spiritually to undergo this affair while also dealing with the trauma of black death in America.
That's such an interesting take on it.
Oh, and I like the way that Leilani doesn't really judge Evie, which is sort of along for the ride. And there's always that potential in death for life and rebirth.
Yeah. I also love that the central tension in the book is between the two women. Like you say, could be sexual, not really sure, but the affair ends up being incidental to what is the core relationship, which is the mistress and the wife.
And it's interesting because there are some really good sex scenes in the book, sex scenes that are desperate and sex scenes that are furtive, but there are also other scenes that are deeply sensual but not necessarily overtly sexual, like when they go to a rock concert and they're in the pit. There's something very kind of erotic about the two of them, like, freaking out to, like, punk rock or whatever it is. And also just, like, the language. Like, Leilani is such a great writer. You know, she'll end chapters with lines like, when I'm ravenous, I know how a star becomes a void. And so there's also that kind of meta-sensuality in her writing.
Oh, I love that line. Let's hear your next one.
I guess moving closer to home and, you know, our context, we are recording here in sunny South Africa, I decided to go for In the Heart of the Country by J.M. Coetzee. And he's kind of fallen out of favor. I don't think it's really cool to read and be interested in Coetzee anymore, which I kind of feel is fair. You know, he's won the Nobel. He's won every single award. And he's pretty old right now, and he's abandoned us for Australia. So, but this is probably the most experimental choice today for me. So In the Heart of the Country is Coetzee at his, like, peak apartheid writing. And it's a very weird book. So it's composed entirely out of diary entries, and they're all written by this white spinster called Magda, who's slowly losing her mind in this like small town. And she lives in the middle of nowhere on her father's farm, and the father has a worker, and the worker has a wife, and that's it. And we start off thinking, oh, you know, this is going to be like an Olive Schreiner story of an African farm, very bucolic. And it devolves into this bloodthirsty, sexual novel where we're not actually sure what is Magda's fantasy and what is real life. So the story gets told over and over again in different ways, restarting and stopping. And we're not sure what's Magda's invention or what is really happening. And she does all sorts of eccentric things. She keeps referring to herself as Magda the Virginal, Magda the Virgin. And she really clings to this idea of innocence, which I think is, at least for Coetzee, a kind of commentary on white settlers, you know, in Africa. But at the same time, she'll do something like wake up in the morning and put an axe through her father's head and kill all the workers on the farm. And then we'll start the day again and she'll be lying in a grave masturbating. It's quite a scandalous novel. Honestly, I'm quite surprised that it did get published in the 60s in the wake of like Christian national education. But it's kind of fantastic. It's kind of still an apt picture of South African life. Like you go to these small dorpies, yeah, like Three Sisters or Frankfort, and you like look at these tiny little towns and you're like, what are people doing here? And the answer is they're kind of playing fast and loose with sex and death and conquering. And it's quite an interesting novel. And I think that the interesting thing about it as well is that Magda is herself struggling to decide whether she's a victim or an aggressor. And so she likes to play act the different roles, but part of her insanity is that she never actually sticks to one role. She refuses to be like the farmer's wife. She refuses to be the victim. She wants to have her cake and eat it too. And I think there's quite a rich commentary in there from Coetzee as well.
So it's kind of like a Groundhog Day situation.
It is a bit like a Groundhog Day situation. It is, except maybe more X-rated, I guess.
Yeah. More sex, more death.
We don't get groundhogs here, do we? So I guess we get like, it would be like a Dussie day, right? We have like Dussies. They're kind of small and cute and they kind of come out of their little holes. So yeah. It kind of has a cult following. I remember that they did an interview with John Malkovich when he was doing the Disgrace film. And he actually said this was his favorite book.
Interesting.
In the heart of the country. Yeah. You know, Coetzee is interesting with his sex scenes. I'm actually just thinking now, in Disgrace, there's this really, like, brimming with pathos sex scene where these two elderly people come to have sex in the dog shelter where they're about to, like, euthanize all the dogs.
Grim.
Yeah, I know. It's really, really bleak. So people don't think of him as a sex writer, but he does write about sex in very, I would say, tormented ways.
Thanks so much, Ephemia. Those are amazing recommendations. I really appreciate you coming onto the podcast to share your books.
Yeah, well, happy reading, I guess. Yeah, thanks so much, Fusty.
Thanks for listening, everyone. This episode was produced by myself and Andre Burnett. We are members of a podcasting collective called Voice Note, and you can check out our other work at voicenote.co.za. If you like the podcast, please rate and review us since it helps other people find us. Thanks to Yowande and Ephemia for making the time to be on this episode. And thanks always to our friends at the Book Lounge for their support. This season of A Reader's Community was made possible by a grant from the National Arts Council, for which we are very grateful. Please join us for a new episode next week. Until then, keep reading. Bop, bop.